once again a review of what we did last time. So so in yesterday's lecture, we discussed the constraint that supersymmetry imposes on the background of the heterotic string in the presence of non-vanishing edge flux. We saw that a few. So what are the properties? First of all, the internal manifold must be complex. So the manifold must be complex. Then we saw that there is this 1-1 form that we called the fundamental form that has to satisfy a few constraints. So first of all, from the anomaly cancellation condition, dd bar of j is equal to I trace of r, which r minus trace of f, which f. And moreover, it has to satisfy a constraint like this, where phi is the dilaton equal to zero. So then we saw that, and again, this thing becomes the Keller form for Calabi-Yau manifolds. Then we saw that there must be a holomorphic 3-0 form in case that we are working with four-dimensional examples. So there must be a holomorphic 3-0 form that we called omega. Well, and the norm of this form omega is related to the dilaton, right? 1/2 log of omega plus constant. So then we saw that the Young-Mills field is constrained to satisfy the Donaldson-Ulmert-Yau equations. So JAB bar FAB bar is equal to zero, and the other components of F are all vanishing. So this was the list of constraints. So and again, as opposed to the type 2B theory, in the heterotic case, the three form is real, and while in type 2B it was complex. So, and this has very important implications for the background. So for example, for the case of the heterotic string, if we compactify just on a Calabi-Yau three-fold flux, it will always break supersymmetry, while if we start with a background that has torsion and is non-Keller, then we see that fluxes are required rather than forbidden. So this is actually what we saw. So fluxes are required rather than forbidden in order to have unbroken supersymmetry. Now, and so what I would like to do today is to discuss a few examples of this construction. So examples. So the first example is actually a very simple one, and it is a compactification of the heterotic string to six dimensions and not to four. And it turns out, so this is an example in which the metric of the internal dimensions, so the metric is a conformal factor times the metric of K3. So this is a scalar function. So it actually turns out that all these constraints that were derived here hold for an internal manifold of any kind of even dimension. Then you have to make a few replacements. For example, this over here would be an N0 form, and so on. But all these constraints hold in the same way. So the first example, one can assume that the metric on the internal space is a scalar function times the metric of K3. So now, it can be shown that this is the only example that in which we can have in which the space-time metric is a scalar function times a Calabi-Yau. So this is actually quite easy to show. So using one of the constraints on that list, using one of the constraints, something like this. And this is the only moment where one actually has to be just a little bit careful with the numbers. So one of the constraints we derived yesterday. So this is actually can be shown that it's nothing else than this constraint over here. So one can show that 2i n minus 1, so this is the complex dimension. So let's try an ansatz like this, a metric that is a scalar function times a Calabi-Yau manifold of complex dimension n, the complex dimension d of log omega is equal to I n d of log omega. So from here you can actually see that this only has a solution, this equation, with a non-constant omega if n is equal to 2. So this means that a metric that is conformal to a Calabi-Yau is only a solution if we are talking about four dimensions. So this example is actually so simple that it can be solved in a closed form. So, and it turns out that the supersymmetric transformations can be brought to a form like this. So we have the Dilatin equation plus 1/2 d bar h on epsilon is equal to 0. And we have the Gravitino equation dm epsilon minus 1/2 dnh gamma mn epsilon is equal to 0. So we're here, I have to find a form that is dual to h. So to capital H is equal to the star of H. So H is simply another scalar function. And as a result from the supersymmetric transformations, and now I'm not going to take care of any constants, we see that phi is going to be proportional to H and that our conformal factor is going to be related to H as well. So this implies that the Dilaton is equal to H and the conformal factor is simply given by e to the minus phi. And again, from this equation, then it follows that we have a covariantly constant spinner on K3 that we know, of course, is true. So we have solved for the supersymmetric transformations. Now we still need an equation for the conformal factor. Well, the conformal factor is going to be determined by d star d omega square is equal to minus alpha prime over 4 trace of r, which r, minus trace of f, which f. So the next thing we actually have to do is find some kind of gauge fields over here and solve these equations for the conformal factor, right? We know that the gauge fields are supposed to satisfy the Donaldson-Ulmbeck-Yau equation. A bar B bar is equal to F A B bar G A B bar. This has to be equal to 0, but this equation is conformal invariant. So it's enough to solve this equation, the one for the gauge field, for K3. Well, people know how to do that. They know how to find solutions of Donaldson-Ulmbeck-Yau for K3. Well, then we plug it into this equation over here, and we find the solution for the Wolf factor. And this is the solution for the problem. Now, Actually, what I would like to mention in this example is that from here we can already see say a few words about moduli fields. So the only equation that determines the conformal factor is this equation over here that is a differential equation, right? So omega is going to be determined up to a constant. Then you go to this, to the result over here, to the ansatz for the metric, and you see that shifting omega by a constant, nothing else than changing the volume. So the volume of the internal manifold is going to be a free parameter. But shifting omega will be a change in the volume. But this constant, this frequency, is not completely arbitrary, because, I mean, we could, for example, run into the situation where we have components of the metric that are negative, that become zero. So we are going to encounter singularities in the metric. And this means that this factor is going to have some kind of lower bound, and the volume is not going to be a completely arbitrary parameter. And this is, of course, good. I mean, if we would like to say that we want to stabilize the volume. So there is a bound on the volume of the internal dimensions. All right. Are there any questions about this example? Well, yeah, so what this actually means is that you have an equation where you have, on the right-hand side, you have a volume, right? So each time you have an alpha prime, you have something like a length. So this is actually one of the properties of the torsional backgrounds, that if you have, so in general, it's not only for the conformal factor, but it's this equation over here, R, which are minus trace. So in general, the anomaly cancellation condition is going to have an alpha prime on the right-hand side, right? Alpha prime over 4, and they scale differently under rescalings of the internal dimensions. This means that this already indicates that things like the volume are going to get, or moduli fields like the volume are going to get a potential. And this is actually true. So you're not allowed to do whatever you want with your potential. So what you're supposed to do is, once you have found an example, you have to show at the end that everything is self-consistent. So if you have assumed that you can use the supergravity approximation, you're assuming a big volume. So each time you write down a concrete example, you have to show that your solution was self-consistent and that the stabilized volume is going to be large at the end. So that's a very good point. So it indicates that, yes, the volume is going to be stabilized. More questions? Good. So the next thing I actually wanted to do is to discuss a construction of an example in four dimensions. Now, in order to do that, I'm going to use a chain of string dualities. Remember that we have discussed the type to be flux backgrounds. So what I would like to do is to start with a background for type to be and show that it can be mapped to one of the torsional backgrounds for the terotic string. In order to do that, I have to work concretely with a metric. So what I will have to do is to work again, I have to work in the orbifold limit. And so orbifolds are nice because they are simple enough so that we can do computations, and they are complicated enough so that we still get non-trivial results. So, but what I would like to do first is to go through some of the steps that I'm going to use to go through some steps of T-duality rules. So T-duality. So what I'm actually after is the concrete fields that I obtain once I apply T-duality to a certain background. Well, I mean, the rules of T-duality are actually quite simple, and they can be derived from the worksheet point of view. So if we, for example, so reduce to the bare bones the idea of T-duality is simply the following. Imagine that we have an action on the a worksheet action that looks somehow like this. We have a field V alpha minus epsilon alpha beta x times d beta V alpha. Oops. Now, so we can actually, so x acts over here as a Lagrange multiplier. We can either solve for the equation of motion for x or the equation of motion for v. So if we have, if we look at the equation of motion for x, then we find that epsilon, so equation of motion for x, then we find that epsilon alpha beta d beta v alpha has to be equal to 0. And as a result, v alpha is equal to d alpha x tilde. Right, we plug this back into the action, and we get 1/2 integral d alpha x tilde, d alpha x tilde, d to sigma. Right, and then we can also consider the variation of, or the equation of motion for v. So we can consider the equation of motion for v. So v alpha, equation of motion for v. So, and we find that v alpha is equal to minus epsilon alpha beta d beta x, right? So we plug it back into the action, and it takes a form like this, 1/2 integral d alpha x d to sigma. Right, either we get an action formulated in terms of x or an action formulated in terms of x tilde. And these two variables are actually related by an equation like this, minus epsilon alpha beta d beta x. Right, and this is nothing else than just changing the sign of the right movers. So what we are doing over here is nothing else than, so you decompose this into the different components, and you find that you are changing the sign of the right movers. XL goes over to XL. All right? Now, if I would have been a little bit more careful, I would have realized that I actually need over here a coefficient that is given by a metric that I could take to be a circle, and then I would have to invert the radius of that circle. Good. What else? So now imagine that so this is for the bosonic theory. Now imagine, where did it go? Here. So on the bosonic fields, T duality is going to act by changing the sign of the right movers, and it's going to leave the left movers invariant. Now imagine that, I mean, since we are doing string theory, we want to include some fermions. So imagine, so type two strings and t-duality. So imagine that we are performing our t-duality in the ninth coordinate, so then we are going to do something like this. This is going to be invariant, and we are going to get one minus sign over here. Now we have to change the sign of the corresponding fermions as well. So as a result, required by supersymmetry, psi, Worksheet fermions are going to go to the left-moving Worksheet fermions, and over here we get a minus sign. So this means that the T-duality is going to change the chirality of the right-moving Ramon sector ground state, right, because we have the minus sign over here. So as a result, we see that, I mean, and the chirality of the ground state is exactly what distinguishes type 2a and type 2b. So under t-duality, type 2a and type 2b is going to be exchanged. So t-duality changes the chirality of the right moving. Moving Ramon sector ground state. So as a result, type 2a and 2b are interchanged. Good. So this means actually that also remember that the type 2B theory has odd brains and the type 2A theory has even brains. So what we actually have to do is to interchange the corresponding potentials, right? So remember now that imagine that we have, for example, a string that has imagine that we have a string that has Neumann boundary conditions on certain dimensions and Dirichlet boundary conditions on the other dimensions. So something like this. Imagine that we have a string that satisfies Neumann conditions. Oops, d sigma x at sigma is equal to 0 is equal to sigma x mu. At sigma equal to pi is equal to 0 for some of the dimensions. And it has Dirichlet boundary conditions on the other dimensions. Xi at sigma equal to pi is equal to d2 on the rest of the dimensions. So then what we can do is to write the mod expansion for something like this. So these are the constants, right? The positions of the D brains. Positions. Of the answer of the D brains. So then we can write down the solution, the mod expansion for fields with these conditions. And you get a result like this. Is equal to x mu a constant plus p mu times tau plus I sum n is not equal to 0, 1 divided by n alpha n mu cosine of n sigma e to the minus I n tau xi tau and sigma is equal to d1 I plus d2 I minus d1 sigma divided by pi. So you can write down the whole mod expansion, right? And you check the boundary conditions. Alpha ni sine of n sigma minus I n tau. Right, and then what else? Then you can split this into right movers and left movers and change the sign of the right movers. And then you see that Dirichlet and Neumann boundary conditions are interchanged. So Dirichlet. And Neumann boundary conditions are interchanged. Right, and this is exactly what we need in order to be able to interchange the type 2A and the type 2B, type 2A and type 2B theories. So, for type 2A, we have dp brains, p brains, where p is even, right? And this is interchanged with type 2B where p is odd. Type 2B where p is odd. Right, and the same, so since this D brains are going to couple to the Ramon-Ramon potentials, we have to interchange the even and the odd form potentials. So this is exactly what we are going to use for our background that I want to present in a moment. So for a background for the type 2B theory. Now, so this kind of duality is what is called a perturbative duality. So this is perturbative, the duality between type 2A and type 2B. So this this is an example of our perturbative duality. So what this means is that we can have a string coupling constant that is small on the type 2a side, and this is going to be mapped to a string coupling constant that is small on the type 2b side. So this is actually pretty easy to see because so you can see that from the space-time axis. Remember that, and what I'm going to do is to look at the space-time axis only for the Navier-Schwarz fields, that is the same for type 2a and type 2b. So in 10 dimensions, the space-time axis for the Navier-Schwarz fields is something like this, d10x. And let me call this the Lagrangian for the Navier-Schwarz fields, right? So what's the statement? The statement is that if we compactify the type 2a theory on a circle of radius r and the type 2b theory on a circle of radius r tilde, then they are going to be related if r times r tilde is equal to alpha prime. So the statement is that once I consider the type 2a theory, so let me write on a formula for this, I compactify it on a circle, I get a nine-dimensional theory. I look only at the zero mode, so this is type 2a. I do the same thing for type 2b, and I compactify on a radius of circle of radius r tilde, and I have a coupling constant that I would like to call gs tilde. So then I get a theory like this. So, and this is the type 2b theory. And they are supposed to be identical. So, and under t-duality, r times r tilde is going to be alpha prime. So they are supposed to be identical. So this means that the coupling constant of the type 2b theory is going to be proportional to the coupling constant of the type 2a theory by something like this. This is an example of a perturbative duality because I can assume that this thing is small and I can assume that this thing is small. So this is perturbative. In contrast to, well, many dualities that have been discussed recently that are actually non-perturbative, where we, for example, have to invert the string coupling constant or things like this. Questions? Good. Why am I going through all this story? Because actually the result that I'm mostly interested in is not only how the radius or the string coupling constant behaves, but what I want to know is how background fields transform. How, for example, a space-time metric behaves under t-duality or the tensor fields. So I would like to couple this to background fields, right? And we know that in the presence of background fields, or Navier-Schwarz background fields, to start with, background fields, we are going to have an action like this. So we are going to have an action involving the metric, a B field, a dilaton, and we know what the things are, right? So 1 divided by 4 pi alpha prime integral d to sigma square root of h alpha beta g mu nu. We know the action for the B field. To sigma, epsilon alpha beta, beta x nu. And we know for the dilaton that the result is 1 divided by 4 pi d to sigma integral square root of h phi times r2. Now we would like to perform the same trick we did a moment ago. So we would like to see how this behaves under t-duality. So we assume that all the fields are independent of one of the dimensions. Let me call this dimension x9. And then we can integrate out different kinds of fields, right? So, and it turns out that the action we want to consider right now, so let me just give you the result. So the action we want to consider is something like this. Due to sigma, once again, we want to introduce Lagrange multipliers, H alpha beta G, and now the dimension I'm going to t-dualize in is the nine dimension, V alpha V beta, plus 2G, 9 mu, V alpha D beta, x mu, plus G mu, V alpha x mu, D beta x mu, plus epsilon alpha beta, B 9 mu, V alpha, D beta, x mu, plus V mu, V alpha, x mu. So, I mean, these are things that are actually quite easy to check. So here we have our Lagrange multiplier that I call x tilde, epsilon alpha beta, V alpha, V beta, plus alpha prime square root of h, R2 times phi. Good. So now, again, I can either solve this equation by looking at the equation of motion for x, or we can look at the equation of motion for v. So, so if we use the equation of motion for v, then, and we eliminate v with the help of that, we get the action in terms of dual variables, right? So the action in terms of dual variables. So we want to eliminate v with the help of its equation of motion, with its equation of motion. Then we get the action formulated in dual variables. So, and the result for this dual variables, and these are the formulas that I'm going to need for my example, are given by this result over here. Divided by G99. So we see, for example, that a B field over here after T duality can turn into a metric. So this is something that will be very important for the example that we are going to discuss in a moment. And B tilde 9 mu is equal to minus B tilde 9 is equal to divided by G99. And finally, the B field of the dual theory is given by this is the action formulated in terms of dual variables. So the principle is exactly the same one as in the illustrative example I showed you at the beginning, where we only considered the x fields, right? So now we have to be careful that we also have to, if we have coupling constants, then we get either an action formulated in terms of the variables G, B, and the Dirac, or we get an action formulated in terms of G tilde, B tilde. And to discuss the Dirac, I have to be a little bit more careful. So we have seen a moment ago that the string coupling constant on the type 2B side is proportional to the coupling constant on the type 2A side, right? By a relation like this. Now, we are compactifying on a circle of radius R. This means that the G99 component of the metric is given by R squared divided by alpha prime. So moreover, we know that the string coupling constant are related to the Dirac, right? So as a result, under T-duality, also the Dirac has to change. minus 1/2 log of G99. Good. Questions? So what I would like to do next is then to construct an example of a torsional background for the heterotic string by using this T-duality rules. This results for the metric and for the tensor fields. So let me do that. Questions. So let's consider a six-dimensional example in the orbital field limit. So what I would like to do again is to start with a flux background for the type 2B theory. And then I would like to use a chain of string dualities to get to a background for the heterotic. So consider first of all everything in the absence of fluxes. So we consider type 2B compactified in a space like this. So type 2B, so without fluxes, compactified on a space like this. Imagine that we have a two torus that we are going to mod out by an orient default action z2 times k3. So the orient default action that we are going to take, so z2 is going to be given by omega times minus 1 to the fl times i89. Let me explain what those things are. So I'm parameterizing this torus here by two coordinates that I call x89. So first of all, this transformation over here is going to change the sign of the 8 and 9 coordinates. So it's a reflection, minus x89. Now this over here is the Wachit parity, and this changes the sign of the left moving fermions. So what this means omega is the Wachit parity. Wachit parity. So it sends sigma to sigma to sigma minus, or sigma goes over to pi minus sigma. So I remember that the type 2B theory is non-chiral. So this is a symmetry. This means it's going to interchange the left movers and the right movers, right? So interchanges x left movers and right movers, right? The next thing, minus 1 to the fl. This is an operator that changes the sign of the left moving fermions. So remember that the Green-Schwarz action in the light cone gauge is something like this, integral d to sigma d plus xi d minus xi minus I sa d minus sa minus I s tilde. So these are my fermions. Now, so this action is invariant under the change of sign of the left moving fermions over here. So what it does is to, so minus 1 to the FL is going to change simply the sign. So SA goes over to minus SA. So, and this again is a symmetry of the action. Good. So what I would like to do is to consider the type 2B theory compactify on a space like this. So this means that I keep only the states that are invariant under this transformation, under this Z2 transformation. Moreover, I have to, since again this is the orbifold limit, I want to work concretely with a metric. I'm also going to work with the orbifold limit of K3. So K3 is going to be the Afar torus divided by Z2 again, and I'm going to use Afar torus, a special type of Afar torus that is simply the product of T2 times T2. The Z2 action, what it does is to change the sign of all this coordinate, so it's a reflection. So this Z2 action is what I would call, in analogy to this thing over here, this I, this is called I4567. Well, why this is a way of representing K3 in the orbifold limit? Well, you can, for example, check that that the Betti numbers are going to agree. You check, for example, the Hodge numbers, right? And this exactly works out right. So you can check that the Betti numbers work out right. Right. In order to do that, I mean, it's a little bit more complicated because you have to be careful with the singularities of this orbifold action. But we are going to work away from the singularities, and this is a way of representing K3. So, why am I actually choosing this? I mean, so why am I choosing to compactify the type 2B theory on a space like this? Because now what I would like to do is to perform two T-dualities in the following way. Actually, I should mention that for things like this, there is a nice reference that are lectures on orientifolds and duality by Atish Dabolkar. So you may want to use that. So there. Very nicely written lectures on orientifolds and duality by Atish Dabolkar. The HEPTH number is 9804208. Good. So it turns out, so why am I telling you the story? Because our Z2 action is going to, again, our Z2 action that we have over here, this thing over here, is going to transform under two T-dualities in the following way. -1 to the FL I89 is going to transform. I'm going to perform two T-dualities in the 8 and 9 directions, and this is going to transform to omega. So this is, I mean, that's actually not very difficult to check. So what you want to do is to check. So this is a nice homework exercise. So this is something that you can do nicely at home. Check that omega -1 to the FL times this parity transformation is equal to the inverse of the two T-dualities times omega times T89. So this is something that you can check. You, for example, start with the left movers in the 8 direction and the right movers, and you see what all these different transformations are going to do. Omega, for example, exchanges the left movers and the right movers. A T-duality is going to change the sign of the right movers. And at the end, you must, from both sides of the equation, you must get the same result. And I'm going to claim that this is true, and I'll leave you as a homework exercise for you. Good. So as a result, after two T-dualities, we are left with a type 2B background in which only omega invariant states are kept, and this is nothing else than a background for type 1. So after two T-dualities, we have a type 2B background in which only, in which only omega invariant states are kept. And you may have heard this before, this is nothing else than a background. This is a background. Is a background for the type 1 theory. Good. So, and now if we have a background for the type 1 theory, we can construct a background for the SO32 heterotic. Right, so the metric to get to a background for the heterotic, well, we are just going to invert the string coupling constant, right? So the metric is equal to the string coupling constant on the type 1 side times the metric on the type 1 side. And the string coupling constant is equal to the inverse. Good. So in the absence, so this is the general principle. So we start with type to be on a background like this. We perform 2T dualities. We get to the type 1 side. Then we apply, we use the relation between the quantities on the type 1 side and on the heterotic side, the string coupling constant and the metric. So be careful, there are many G's over here. So this thing with the indices is a metric. This thing without the index is the string coupling constant, right? String coupling. So, and in this way, we can get all the quantities on the heterotic side. And now we say, yes, good. We know how to construct flux backgrounds on the type 2B side. So we know how to construct flux backgrounds on the heterotic side. So this is a nice recipe to construct torsional backgrounds. And let's see if this procedure really works. So, and actually, before I turn on the fluxes on the type 2B side, I would like to mention a few properties. So, for example, without fluxes, the metric on the type 1 and heterotic side, it's going to be nothing else than K3 times T2. So without fluxes, so if we do this duality chain, so without fluxes, the metric on the type 1s or on the heterotic side, well, something like this, right? So we have a space time 0, 1, 2, 3 plus the metric of K3 plus the metric of a torus, dz3 bar. Good. So we can compute things of this background, like for example Betti numbers, right? So we want to know properties of the space. So we would like to know, for example, the topology. And well, we can then talk. So this is again. So this space is K3 times T2. On the heterotic side. So, and we would like to compute the Betti numbers of this. Well, we know how to do that, right? So we know the Betti numbers of the two torus, right? These are one, we have two one cycles, we have one two cycle. So this is I is equal to 0, 1, 2. And we know the Betti numbers of K3, BI of K3, right? So these Betti numbers are 1, 0, 22. 0 and 1. So again, here I is going from 0 to 4. I is 0 to 3. 0 to 2, excuse me. So I is equal to 0, 1, 2. Good. So now the Betti numbers count the number of linearly independent harmonic P forms that is equivalent to the number of irreducible P cycles. So as a result, we can simply compute the Betti numbers of the product. The Betti numbers of the product are simply, and again, you can check this slowly, but it's very simple. So 1, 2, 23, 44, 23, 2, and 1. So I is 0. Yep. So these are the Betti numbers, and you can also compute the Euler characteristic. So these are quantities characterizing the topology of this manifold, right? The Euler characteristic is simply the product, so it's 0, right? The Euler characteristic of the torus vanishes. So, good. This means in the absence of fluxes, we have a background K3 times T2. We have certain Betti numbers. We have a certain, so this space has a certain topology. And the next thing I would like to do is to include some fluxes on the type 2B side. And then I'm going to use my T-duality rules, right? So I went through all the derivation for you a moment ago just to say that I'm going to use that formula to compute the metric on the heterotic side after two T-dualities, to compute the B field after two T-dualities, and so on. So good. So what are we going to do? We are going to take type 2B on the space I presented for you a moment ago. We are going to include fluxes. Fluxes on the type 2B side. 2B side. So what do we want to do? We want, again, to include something like this, right? We have discussed things like this in detail. We want to preserve supersymmetry, so we are going to set that component equal to 0. And, well, we want to write down something, some expression explicitly for the Neville-Schwarz and the Ramon 3 form, and here it is. I claim that a form that satisfies this condition is given. So the Neville-Schwarz 3 form is something like this, dz1 bar, which dz2. And again, this is a nice homework exercise for you. Go home, and from these forms I'm going to write down for you, check that they satisfy the imaginary self-dual condition. And, well, this one's actually very simple, that the 0-3 part vanishes. Dz1, which dz2 bar, which dz3 bar, plus complex conjugate. Then we want to use an F3 that is given by tau minus a dz1 bar, which dz2, which dz3 bar, minus d dz1, which dz2 bar, which dz3 bar, plus complex conjugate. So again, compute g3. That is equal to F3 minus tau H3, and check that it satisfies the imaginary self-dual condition over there. Moreover, I'm using over here a vanishing Ramon-Ramon scalar, and I'm setting tau is equal to I. So. Excuse me? Good. So, and I'm using tau is equal to I. Now, A and D are some constants that I'm just going to write down for you that are constrained, again, by a flux quantization condition and anomaly cancellation condition. So I can just believe that there's only one, or there are actually only two possible choices. So the concrete numbers actually are not that important for what I want to discuss. Yes. we are, yeah, so what we are going to do is we are going to use tau is equal to z0 plus I e to the minus phi. Yes. Yes. Yes, yes. So this is exactly what we are going to do. Yeah, we are going to set. So yeah, we have to be a little bit careful. So we have to watch our step. We have always to check, I mean, that everything is going to be satisfied so that super gravity is going to hold on both sides. You're exactly getting to the right point. We must be careful with what we do with the coupling constants. So this is why it's important to check on all, I mean, this is why it's actually non-trivial to check that on all the sides of the dualities, supergravity is still going to be, a valid approximation. Yes, so our constants are going to be A and D is equal to 1 plus I0, or A and D can be equal to 1 and 1, whatever. So these constants are not so important. And so the next thing that I would like to do is to use this this form of the background. And remember a moment ago, so this over here is the Nevers-Schwarz 3 form. So, and as we have seen a moment ago when we discussed the Boucher rules, Nevers-Schwarz 3 form can turn into a metric after t-duality. So this is exactly what we are going to see. So after t-duality, we get on the type 1 side, let me call this 2T dualities. Well, we get a metric on the type 1 side. So let me just give you the result, G11 bar. Again, I'm working over here with a certain form of a K3 that is given by a product of 2 tori divided by this parity transformation, DZ2. DZ2 bar. Now comes the important part. 1 divided by 2, G3, 3 bar, DZ3 plus 2D, Z2 bar, DZ1, minus 2A, Z1 bar, DZ2 square. Right? So what used to be, so this is the metric on the internal dimensions, what used to be the product of K3 times a 2 torus, now becomes this strange thing. So we have this twist in the metric, right? So what this constants A and D, this Nevers-Schwarz 3 form causes for us, is that we have this twist in the metric, right? So they appear over here on this as a shift in DZ3. Well, why is this so important? Because this is going to change our Betti numbers. So remember, maybe I should leave them over there. So remember that we are working over here most of the time we started with a torus, so we have a set of discrete identifications, right? So over here, so this metric is going to have a set of discrete identifications. Let me write them down for you. So Z1, Z2, Z3 is going to be identified with Z1, Z2, Z3 plus 1. This is Z1, Z2, Z3 plus I. Now we must be a little bit careful. Z2, Z3. Has to be identified with Z1, Z2 plus 1. So, right, if we decide to identify Z2 with Z2 plus 1, then at the same time, we must shift this quantity over here, Z3, in the following way. So Z3 plus 2D, Z1, this we want to identify with Z1, Z2 plus I, Z3 minus 2ID, Z1. And the last one, Z1, Z2, Z3. Well, we want to identify this with Z1 plus 1, Z2, and now we have to shift Z3 to A, Z2. We want to identify this. So these are the discrete identifications for the new space, Z3 plus 2A, I, Z2. So we have a new set of discrete identifications. So what this means is that now you want to compute the Betti numbers and you look at all possible one forms. And you see that the only one form that is going to be compatible with those discrete identifications is this thing over here. But it's really easy to see that the thing is not closed. So as a result, the Betti numbers are going to change. So the only one form is not compatible, and the Betti numbers for, let me call this the twisted product, maybe product with a T or something, are going to, so this one form is going to disappear, so, and the Betti numbers are going to change as a result, 42, 20, 01. So this means that you, so what I want to illustrate by looking at the Betti numbers is that the topology of this, I mean, the properties are really changing of this background. So because even the topology changes, we go from, so once, if we have no fluxes, we have Betti numbers like this, right? Once fluxes are included on the heterotic side, we see that the one form disappears, the closed one form. So the Betti numbers change, the topology changes. So fluxes on the heterotic side have such a strong back reaction on the metric that all the properties are going to change. Yes. Yes. Well, I mean, in principle, I mean, I don't have to worry about things like that, because I mean, I'm assuming that I can work with those superpotentials, and those are going to be protected against alpha prime corrections. I mean, there is a nice argument why it's protected against alpha prime corrections. So it's quite robust, right? You're talking about GS projects, I understand that. But so I'm assuming at this moment that there are no GS corrections as well. So I mean, this is something that is plausible, but it has not been shown. But yes, you have to be careful with that. So there is a good argument, there is a non-renormalization theorem for alpha prime corrections. For GS corrections, you must be careful. So I would claim that it's plausible that there are no corrections, but it has not been definitively proven. Yes, you must be careful. Well, you can have, for example, you could have non-perturbative effects. So I'm talking about perturbative corrections. Yes, yes. So all these non-renormalization theorems always hold only for perturbative corrections. Well, these non-renormalization theorems are things that protect your superpotential. They don't protect the Keeler potential. But the superpotential is actually all we needed. So, okay, you already see that weird things are happening. So the background changes the topology. Now you can check that now you compute the metric, right? So you can compute the metric, and you can compute the B field that you get on the type one side, and then you go ahead and you can check that that Strom-Jost conditions are satisfied, right? So this is the result for the metric, and then you can compute the B field on the type one side. 1/GbA(C1̄), dz2, which dz3̄, minus dz2̄, dz1, plus complex commutate. So, and you can compute the type 1 coupling. Type 1 coupling is equal to gb/2 g33. And you can check, it's possible to check that the condition on the H flux that was derived by Strominger, d̄J, is satisfied, right? So once you know the metric, you know J, right? So you know the fundamental form, you know the form of H, and then you can check that this condition is actually satisfied. So, and again, the new background is, so this is one of the torsional personal backgrounds one of the examples, but I mean, we really reduced this to, I mean, this thing to pieces, right? We are working here, I mean, explicitly with a metric that is flat. We are working in the orbifold limit. So this is a little bit the price we have to pay in order to handle one of these backgrounds. And I think it would be very, very interesting to see if one could find torsional backgrounds away from the orbifold limit that I actually used here. Yes. The what? Yes, that's a very good question. I don't have them over here, but you must be quite careful because now once again you're working with torsional background that is non-killer, and the Hodge numbers are no longer going to be related in an easy way to the Betti number. So this is something that should be computed. Yes. So I don't know. Questions? Good. So with this example, again, I tried to illustrate that the price you have to pay to get closer to the real world is that your background is going to be very complicated. Fluxes, well, yes, they are going to induce a potential for moduli fields as well, but they are going to backreact on the metric, even changing the topology, changing completely the properties of the internal manifold, right? And again, so manifolds with torus and this non-killer backgrounds is something that mathematicians always will say, well, we don't know anything about, so we are left more or less on our own in order to describe properties of this kind of background. So let me now finish with some conclusions. So string theory is a very ambitious project, right? I mean, as string theory is on our list of things to do, we have, for example, we have to find a theory of quantum gravity. We have to explain why we live in four dimensions. We want to find a theory of everything. I mean, it would be real nice to predict maybe the mass of the electron, 0.511 MeV. We want to predict the weak mixing angle. And all this kind of things. And we even would like to know why is gravity, for example, weaker than all the forces in nature, right? I mean, these are all very formidable questions, right? So, I mean, I'm not saying that all these questions are impossible. I mean, we know, for example, Maxwell's theory, just a set of few equations, I mean, governs all the world around us. I mean, more or less everything we see except a few facts, like why are we able to keep the feet on the ground? But, I mean, for the rest, it's all Maxwell's theory, just a set of four equations. So, in string theory, I would say it's fair to say that we have not reached our goals yet. So we have not answered any of those questions on the list I gave you a moment ago. So, but I hope that I convinced you that we have more or less bits and pieces of the whole story. I mean, that the situation is not as desperate, right? I mean, good things about string theory is that we, for example, have no free coupling constants, right? I mean, it would be really bad if we are talking here about string theory and there are all these coupling constants that we don't know how to determine. No, in string theory, everything is fixed dynamically. So everything is formulated in terms of scalar fields. Either, for example, the dilaton, it's the string coupling constant, right? Or we have the moduli fields play the role, for example, of coupling constants. So it's crucial. And the dynamics is going to say, well, what expectation value each of these moduli fields is going to have. So everything is going to be determined dynamically. So how this dynamics works, well, again, hopefully I've convinced you that we know bits and pieces of the story. I've tried to motivate that fluxes appear naturally if we include quantum gravity corrections. Fluxes are going to induce potentials for moduli fields, Well, but the little piece of the story I didn't tell you is what is actually what picks out the fluxes. There are many of them, right? I mean, I could have chosen any kind. So I've, so to say, replaced something that was a continuous parameter by something that was discrete, right? But what is going to pick out the flux? Maybe it's picked out entropically. Maybe there is some kind of principle, some kind of statistics. Well, at this moment, I don't, I mean, we don't know how this is going to work, but at least we have replaced continuous parameters by discrete ones, and hopefully we are going to hear more about the selection of the different different vacua, the different flux vacua from other speakers in this school. And this is actually all I wanted to say. Yes. Well, I mean, you should. I mean, it's you're completely right. I mean, we must be careful what we do with the coupling constant. We must always watch our step, as I mentioned a moment ago. But you shouldn't take this chain of string dualities actually too seriously. You could have just started, for example, on the. So this is why we always had to check that the constraints are going to be satisfied. You can, for example, just start on the theoretic side. On K3 times C2 and look at deformations of the metric, right? And try to construct your example only by starting on the theoretic side. And you would come to the conclusion that the kind of kind of background you get is something like this. And this is actually an idea for well, yeah, right, but the, I mean, they're simply related, they're proportional, right? So you can, okay, imagine that you take K3 times T2 only, and then you say, well, what simple things can I do to my metric so that I get a manifold that is, for example, non-Kähler, and what kind of H-fit can I write down so that it solves one of these torsional conditions? And then you would come to the conclusion, well, this is a candidate. And I think what would be a very nice exercise is to see if this, for example, is the only kind of a deformation of K3 times T2 one can do. So you can work everything out only on the theoretic side. So this chain of string dualities, you must be careful with that you always have weak coupling everywhere. But you can take it as an inspiration, so to say. And they say, well, let's forget where this came from on the type 2B side and work only on the theoretic side. So you can do that if you want. More questions?